Hi, everyone. It's Janice, host of the Divorcing Religion podcast. Thanks for tuning into my show, whether you're joining me on audio or video. I've heard from some folks recently who have told me just how much the show has meant, and some of them have even found it not only to be life-changing, but life-saving, as they felt there was no one else who understood what they were going through, and they found the Divorcing Religion podcast, and they started feeling encouraged. Please help me keep my show on the air. Become a member by clicking the join button on the Conference on Religious Trauma YouTube channel. Thanks. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Divorcing Religion podcast. I'm your host, Janice Selby. I'm a registered professional counselor and a religious recovery consultant. I do have content warning for our show today. We will be talking a little bit about human trafficking and forced labor. And with that said, my guest today is Jeff Beaumont. Jeff was born into Scientology and educated at the local Scientology school in Vancouver, BC. At age 14, he was kidnapped and trafficked to the USA to perform labor in the Sea Org branch of Scientology. During that time, Jeff was forced to disconnect from his mother, who was out of Scientology at that point. On returning to Vancouver, he spent about 10 more years on staff at the Church of Scientology. In 2012, Jeff woke up, and he has been working on his recovery ever since. Recently, he started speaking out against the abuses of Scientology on YouTube and podcasts. His YouTube channel is called PTS for Life, and I want to thank my dear friend Heather for telling me about Jeff. Heather's been a big supporter through my own deconstruction, and I'm grateful that she connected me with Jeff. So welcome, Jeff. It's nice to have you here.
It's really good to meet you, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk to you.
A fellow British Columbian. That is wonderful. I don't often have fellow British Columbians on my show, so that's really nice. And I do love Vancouver. Anytime I have the chance to get down there, it's just such a beautiful city.
Yeah, and I love Kelowna, so we'll have to meet up sometime.
For sure. So a couple things from the introduction there. Boy, when you say that you did 10 more years then on staff for the Church of Scientology. We have a lot of viewers and listeners to this podcast who were clergy, who spent a lot of time, invested a lot of time, energy, resources, sacrificed a tremendous portion of their life to the religion called High Demand Group that they were involved in. And starting over can be rough, because you've invested so many years, so you're in very good company here.
Yes, awesome. Yeah, that is one thing I've learned since speaking out, actually, is the similarities, and I'm not alone, which is really, it's heartening. It's disheartening at the same time, but it's heartening to know that I'm not alone, and there are other people who understand what I did go through, because up until recently, I haven't really been looking at that aspect of it. I've just been kind of looking in, whereas now I'm looking out, which feels good.
Yeah, totally agree. I wonder if you would tell us a little bit about your childhood. So your mom got out at some point, so obviously she was in at some point, and that must have been when you were born, when she was deeply involved in Scientology.
Yeah, so both my parents are actually from, my mom's from Edmonton area, but they were both met in Toronto at the Church of Scientology there, and that was in the 70s, and when I was born in 1982, they basically 3 months after I was born, they trucked off over here to BC, and they were both involved in the local organization here. Both were on staff. My mother left staff around 1990-ish. Because of some internal stuff with the organization and some disagreements. Also at that time, my parents had divorced, and, basically my mom had custody of me, but I didn't like the person she was living with. And so I requested to go live with my dad, and, he was still very involved in Scientology and sent me to a Scientology school and everything, throughout my entire life.
Wow. So as in Vancouver, a Scientology school, just like people have Catholic schools and Christian schools, there is a Scientology school in Vancouver.
Well, there used to be. Okay. It is now defunct.
Great.
It went through a couple ownerships and some management, but it went off by the wayside quite a while ago.
Glad to hear it. Yeah. I'm curious then, so you were living with your dad because you didn't like the fellow your mom was living with at the time. So then how did the kidnapping, trafficking part come about, if you're comfortable sharing about that?
So around the age of 11 or 12, I started doing courses in Scientology, like actually at the church itself. I was raised in the halls, but I never really did very much with it, except for in my schooling. When I was 14 years old, there was what's called a mission, which is basically Sea Org members who go around and recruit people for the Sea Org. That's their whole purpose. It's just to, usually children, to convince their parents to give up their kids and send them off to the Sea Org. Now, it's important to know that at the time, my mom had guardianship legally. She was my guardian. My dad had no guardianship over me. But I was living with my dad. So he said it was okay that I go. But in fact, my guardian didn't. So my guardianship was transferred to another Scientologist in LA illegally. Her name was Judy, and she was a family friend. But because my mom didn't know that I had even gone down, she freaked out. Obviously, rightfully so.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pulled back up to Canada to convince her that this is what I wanted to do and not what the church wanted me to do.
Mm-hmm.
I was coached intensively before that on what to talk to her about, what to say, what not to say. And eventually I did convince her. But the initial action of me going down there was kidnapping, because technically, legally, I wasn't allowed to go. So I was a minor.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. What a hard time that must have been for your mom. That must have just been brutal. And so, like you say, you were coached in what to say to your mom. And then was the Sea Org what you thought it would be? First of all, what is Sea Org for people who are unfamiliar? Is it actually on the ocean? Is there a boat?
That's a good question. So originally, yes. So the Sea Org was started in 1967, and it's basically the most dedicated members of Scientology.
Mm-hmm.
The Sea Org itself actually doesn't exist as an entity. It's not a legal entity at all. It's just a bunch of people that work together with a common purpose. The Sea Org is what people generally think about with Scientology, about the billion-year contract, where you literally sign a contract saying, I dedicate myself for the next billion years. And essentially, all it is a slave labor camp. They get paid about $50 a week, usually, mm-hmm. in the States at least. And they work approximately 80 to 100 hours per week. That's 7 days a week. If you're doing well, like you're producing, then they will give you a little bit of time off on Sundays to like do your laundry and go get your, you know, deodorant and stuff like that. But it is literally like 7 a.m. till at least 11 p.m. working, all
you
for the aims of Scientology.
I mean, you were 14 years old. How can a 14-year-old body stand to be working 80 to 100 hours a week?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when I was down there, there was a big evolution or a project to release some materials. And the longest I worked straight without stopping was 36 hours.
And without stopping?
Yeah, no stopping. Oh, so like, you know, stopping for obviously food every now and then. But I was working as a Canadian in the California desert in Gilman Hot Springs, which is where the secret of gold base is for people who follow Scientology. It's where the international base is for Scientology. 110 degree heat, like not something I'm used to. And unsurprisingly, shortly after that, I had an accident where I burnt my leg. And that got me into trouble for burning my leg. Because I was exhausted, of course. And that leads into a whole thing where, as you mentioned in the intro, where I had to disconnect from my mom because she was essentially being blamed for why I was having accidents and so forth. Mm. Yeah. So it's a whole story.
Wow. So Sea Org isn't necessarily on the ocean. You actually were in the desert, but it's the very dedicated slave labor part of Scientology. And so how long were you in there? Were you still getting any schooling at that time?
No, I was not. That's the funny thing, which I didn't really think about. The main reason, there's two reasons I joined the Sea Org. One was because I didn't like school. I was a fairly decent student. I just didn't like it. Mm-hmm. Now that I look back on it, I think I just didn't like the school I was in, mm-hmm. right? Scientology-based school. But the other one is I had my main purpose in life was, and still is, to help people. And I was under the impression that by becoming what's called an auditor or a counselor in Scientology, mm-hmm. That I was going to be helping people on the highest level that I possibly could. And mm-hmm. so that appealed to me. And I was pushed very, very hard into my head to convince me to join by the recruiters. So I went down there and I was only doing what's called the Estates Project Force. And that is the entry part of the Sea Org where you prove your worth. It's basically, I think, about 8 hours worth of physical labor a day. And I think 5 hours of study, something like that. I forget what the exact schedule was. And that basically is all the basics, the courses that you do before you fully join the Sea Org and become a Sea Org member. So I never finished that. And after I got sick and hurt, I didn't want to be there anymore. And so I convinced the people there that if they let me go, I will go back to my local org in Vancouver and join staff there and fulfill my duties, as it were. And so mm-hmm. I signed a contract and was shipped back to Vancouver.
Wow. Okay. So how old were you when you got back to Vancouver?
Same age. And it would have been 14 because I was only there for about 3 months.
You were so smart to think your way out and navigate your way back from that. I'm really glad you were able to do it because who knows what would have happened if they had kept you, you know, just grinding you down at that speed. That's just so unacceptable. It's really breathtaking. And so you got back to Vancouver, but you were disconnected from your mom.
Yeah. So basically, yeah, I'll give a very quick overview of how it works. In Scientology, if you are connected with someone who is antagonistic towards the religion, Scientology in general, or Scientologists, they're what's called a suppressive person. And if you're connected with one of those people, that's the cause of why you get sick or have accidents. Yeah. There's two things you can do. There's handle. This is all in policy written by L. Ron Hubbard. You can handle, which was not going to happen. Because for various reasons, or disconnect. Those are the only two options.
What's handle?
Well, so handle would be like if the person's objections could be gotten over, like they had an idea that Scientology was this way, and you could educate them and basically change their mind and stop them from being antagonistic somehow.
Right.
That wasn't going to happen with my mom for various reasons. And, you know, much like me, she's very stubborn. that's where I get my red hair from. So we tend to be stubborn. Awesome. And so what they did, and without any real desire to try and handle, they told me that I had to disconnect. And I actually have a letter written in my own handwriting. Sorry, this is difficult when I think about it now. Mm-hmm. I wrote to my mom and told her that because she was out ethics or not doing good things towards mm-hmm. Scientology, that I was no longer going to talk to her.
Yes, you were utterly brainwashed at that point and under a tremendous amount of pressure, even which your mom would have understood because she had been a member for so long. So your mom even knew that it wasn't you talking but it was the organization that was really using you and controlling you.
And she told me that.
Okay.
She passed away last year. And I was very thankful that we had reconnected as I reconnected with her as an adult.
Wonderful.
And I was able to basically apologize for that. And it's not something a kid should have to apologize for, but I felt necessary to do that.
I'm so glad that you were able to reconnect with your mom. That's, I imagine she probably had some of her own insights and apologies in whatever way or version, just things to share with you as well, because it's also painful to see how we have hurt our children. So I'm really glad that you had that opportunity to reconnect with her. So you came back and now you're back in Canada. Did you go back into the Scientology school, like a high school situation, and then you're also working part-time at the church, or what happened then?
Nope. They never put me back in school. And I might have at one point had to do some basic courses. I don't recall actually doing them, but I'm sure legally they probably would have had me do that for a little bit, at least until I was 16, mm-hmm. which I think is the age where in Canada where you can decide not to go to school, I think.
Right. And were you living with your dad again?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was.
Now, and he was didn't have concerns for you? He wasn't concerned about your leg and about all these other things that were going on?
No, he was pretty busy with his life. He was also the executive director of CCHR, which was the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, which is the front group for Scientology that attacks psychology, psychiatry, and so forth. So I was working in the exact same like little physical office as him on a post that was separate, but next to him. And so I think that was kind of why it didn't bother him, because I was there, right? Mm-hmm. I was in front of him and I was doing stuff. And mm-hmm. I was essentially working towards the greatest purpose I could, right, in his mind.
Right. And did you feel the same? Like at that time, you were still all in and you didn't really want to do anything else? Or were you questioning things?
Yeah, I mean, I was struggling with a lot of stuff. And I will give a warning just to your listeners that there mm-hmm. will be talk about self-harm and stuff coming up. So
thanks.
Just so people are aware. Mm-hmm. So I was definitely very in the mindset of Scientology is the best thing ever, for sure. I had a superiority complex and chip on my shoulder like you would not believe. Because I as a 14-year-old and 15-year-old and 16-year-old, which is the ages that I was on staff at that point, I was aware in my own mind that I was doing the best thing for the planet, right? Mm-hmm. There literally is no other option to save the planet than Scientology in my mind.
Wow. Okay.
However, at the same time, I was struggling a lot with depression mm-hmm. and suicidal ideation. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I did actually attempt mm-hmm. suicide while I was actually at the organization itself. Mm-hmm. And that came up in, because I wasn't doing well, that came up in an ethics handling while I was on staff, which is basically ethics is when you're in trouble in Scientology. Mm-hmm. And I confessed to having these thoughts and confessed to having an attempt. And then I was told by one of the most senior people there at the time, as well as now, in fact, that if I went through with the act of taking my own life, I was just going to come back worse than I was now. Mm. And so that instead of looking, asking what was going on or anything like that, that was all they told me. And then I just walked away from that with that understanding that now there's literally nothing I can do. So that was my experience while on staff then.
A lot of pressure.
That was kind of my mindset.
Yeah, a lot of stress. So then bring us forward a little bit. When did you really start thinking about, I have to leave? Or what kind of cracked you open and gave you a seed of doubt that maybe this isn't all there is?
I can't speak to specifically what that was then, because I did kind of leave. I left staff for a while, and I was just kind of like on the bubble, just floating around in the, as a public. And I did some public courses, and then I joined staff again, then I left and everything. But the real thing that really got me to start speaking out and realize like truly how damaging is just hearing about the abuses of people, and then relating it to myself as well as to what I actually experience. One thing in Scientology they teach you is what's true for you is true for you. That's like a big, it's very important. It's if it's not true for you, it's not true. That's it. But at the same time, if you don't agree with Scientology, then you're wrong. Right? So it's like, it's this dichotomy that like two things clashing. And the more you look at Scientology, the more contradictions that you do actually see. But the one specific thing that really got me thinking was what's called the Ideal Org program. And what this is every single Scientology organization, their reasoning why they're not expanding and Scientology isn't doing well is because their buildings aren't very nice, which is so dumb. And so they're constantly fundraising for a new building. And in fact, for Vancouver, they've been doing it for over 20 years and still haven't got enough money to buy a new building and everything. But that constant like digging in for money, and that's all the focus was, like all the staff meetings was money. Everything was money related and getting more money. And that's what really started getting me thinking, like, maybe this isn't quite what they're saying it actually is. And that's kind of when I started fading away and looking at stuff. The internet's a very powerful place for people who are questioning.
Right. And had you been advised to protect yourself, I got my air quotes going, protect yourself on the internet, by not reading anything critical of Scientology? Were those rules at play?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that was always drilled into my head because my dad being in the position that he was in, his job was literally to look at the media and see what bad things are being said about Scientology. And so that like, that's constantly drilled in your head that anything that media says is lies. Right. If it's about Scientology, if it's not positive, it's a lie. And then so that's constantly drilled in. It makes it very easy to self-police and realize or think to yourself that what you're thinking is not actually true. You're basically gaslighting yourself, right?
Mm-hmm. Wow. When most people think of Scientology, I think we probably picture Los Angeles and the building, the blue building or whatever buildings are there, and famous movie stars that are involved in it. And I recently had the pleasure of interviewing Margaret Atwood, Canadian author and icon, and she wrote The Handmaid's Tale, which became a TV show. And it's all about, you know, fundamentalism gone completely amok in society. And the woman who starred in the show as the main handmaid is a Scientologist.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy, that's wow. When we are in something, we often just don't see it. We're able to compartmentalize things to such a degree that we don't see the forest for the trees. It's really incredible.
And Elizabeth Moss is a hardcore dyed-in-the-wool Scientologist. Very, very, very involved.
And is it your understanding or your even just your thoughts on it? Are most people born into it, or in places like Los Angeles, do actors get sucked in because there are producers and whatever people who can help them get up the chain in Hollywood involved?
You know, I think that people have a wrong understanding of how popular Scientology is in Hollywood. I think because there are a few and were quite a few big names. The names that are big right now, it's really just Tom Cruise. You know,
not even
I guess
John
Elizabeth
Travolta
Moss.
Anymore? Sorry? John Travolta.
He is, but you know, what's he done lately? You know, most of his movies, he's like basically a B or a C level actor at this point, right? But you know, the bigger names that are out now, Michael Pena, Elizabeth Moss, And a bunch of them are leaving. I mean, Danny Masterson just got sent to prison for 30 years for stuff that he did mm-hmm. as a Scientologist mm-hmm. And was condoned by Scientologists. I won't go into what he did, but, okay. you know, the name that the popularity of Scientology in Hollywood is not there like it used to be.
Oh, I'm so glad.
I just think people realize it's bad for their careers, you know?
Okay.
And there are no celebrity Scientologists that are allowed to talk about Scientology right now. They're not allowed to.
Really?
They actually sign. Yeah, they sign agreements. Like, let's say, I think it was Jimmy Kimmel recently had Elizabeth Moss on, and he had to sign an agreement that he would not mention anything about Scientology, and no interviewers are allowed to mention it. They sign contracts, like, and if they don't sign it, they just don't get the interview.
I see. So
it really is a very taboo subject right now, more so than I think people realize.
Right. Okay. And on the topic still of contracts, I think back to a few minutes ago when you mentioned the billionaire contract. And so those of us who aren't Scientologists have often heard of this billionaire contract. And I know some people can get into the eye rolling and how ridiculous that is, but I would like to remind people that encouraging your three-year-old or your five-year-old to say the sinner's prayer and to commit themselves for the rest of their life to following Jesus and following God, that is the same as a billionaire contract. They, you know, a child's oath, pledge, covenant, vow, promise would not hold up in a court of law. And so I think it's cruel to encourage children or teens or vulnerable people to make any kind of lifelong contract like that. And that's how people typically get into high demand groups. They're in a vulnerable state. They're in a time of transition. They may be children, adolescents with a lot of peer pressure and potential chaos in the home. They may have just lost a partner to death or divorce or had a job loss. They may have moved across the country and they don't know anyone. So they may be in prison. These are times when we're vulnerable, when we're in a state of transition. And some people get sucked in because they want to change the world. And this program, this group, this cult promises that with them you can change the world. So no one joins a cult. People join a good thing. They join a great group, a wonderful community. So really, we mustn't sit in judgment of people who fall into these groups.
Yeah, absolutely. I will answer a question you asked just shortly before that in regards to this too. Is in Vancouver, most of the people who are on staff now or involved in Scientology are older people, like as in not older people, although they are, but people who have been involved for quite a while. And then also the second generation of those people. So I actually recently visited the Church of Scientology of Vancouver, BC, I should say, and did a little bit of filming outside. And that didn't make them very happy. But most of the people who arrived for staff and so forth were all the same people. And I had a conversation with one of them. And I said, so how's things going here? Because him and I used to be very good friends. And I still consider him a friend.
Okay.
But he said, oh, yeah, same old crew, a few new faces. And that really is telling that people just aren't joining Scientology, especially on a local level. Where they do find people, though, is internationally. There's a lot of push for it in areas like Taiwan, in areas where they don't have access to a lot of internet necessarily as well as people who are looking to come across to work in
yes.
a country, say like the United States and so mm-hmm. forth. So they'll recruit them from different areas. At a local level in Vancouver, they push a lot to recruit international students because there is a school like two doors down from the organization here, and I have it on good authority that they're recruiting people from there.
Wow, that's terrifying and so predatory.
Yeah, exactly. They don't know anything about Scientology, you know. And in fact, when I was down there standing outside filming the organization, I had conversations with some international students and was basically educating them on what it actually is as opposed to what they say they are.
Oh my gosh, you might have just prevented them from getting sucked into a cult. That's fantastic. I'm glad you were able to do that.
That's my goal.
Wow, incredible. So you left Scientology and then you were just kind of in back in the regular world, but you had been, had it been kind of fits and starts with you leaving? You had kind of left before and went back. And so it maybe wasn't as shocking as it was for someone like Chris Shelton, maybe, who left and he was kind of right out in the regular world. And so you had a bit more gradual integration there. Did you talk with other people about it? I mean, you're going for a job interview. Is it the type of thing that you say to somebody, or what was your reintegration like back into the regular world?
Well, so no, I didn't talk to anybody about it. And in fact, my wife, now we were dating. It took me, I think, 5 or 6 years to go over my history with her.
Wow.
I was embarrassed. In my mind, anyway, there was still very much a stigma attached to being a Scientologist. Even when I was in Scientology, there was a stigma in my mind about it. I was never like loud and proud saying I'm a Scientologist and stuff like that. I was very much like a need to know kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me a while. For about 10 years, I listened, watched everything I could. Very, very much like Chris Shelton's material. Like, he was so instrumental in my understanding of what Scientology really was with his videos. And him and I talk every now and then. I've done a podcast with him. And
yeah, he's delightful.
It's amazing how much content there is for someone who's wanting to know the truth about what it actually is and how it works. It's quite remarkable. So you guys should definitely go check that out. Chris Shelton, MSC. Yes.
That's right.
He was on your program as well, as you've mentioned. But anyway, so I spent about 10 years really watching and reading everything I could about what it is. And last year is really actually when I really started talking to ex-Scientologists who are out.
Mm-hmm.
Apostate Alex, who has a YouTube channel as well, Alex Barnes Ross. He's in the UK. He really helped me out with my channel and like, you know, explaining stuff as well. So I think the biggest learning in connecting with people who were in before is learning that they're not all evil people, like I was taught, right? Because even in the back of my mind, I had this idea that these people who are speaking out, there's like a guilt attached to it where they're bad people. Mm-hmm. And that was still very much there. Until you start talking to them and you realize that they're not, they're just human beings. So yeah, that was probably the biggest learning I'd say from that. And that was kind of my transition.
Okay. So it was really helpful for you to be able to connect with other people who understood your experience, people who had their own lived experience with Scientology. They had made it out and they are surviving. They're doing just fine, even though they left. What would you say has been the hardest thing?
Oh, that's easy to answer. Recognizing who I am and how I think and how I react as being me versus Scientology. It's, you know, I think there's a very specific difficulty with second generations, but like, and I know quite a few of them and I've talked with them. Understanding the brainwashing versus your basic real personality is probably the most difficult thing to get over. And it's a daily thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I still make realizations on a daily basis of whether I actually think a certain way. And so my strategy for that would be if it's a negative thought or I feel like it might be a negative or science logical reaction, I ask myself, I literally sit back and I out loud ask myself, is this how I really feel? And start asking my questions about it. And then that helps to break any automatic reaction that has been trained into me and then really evaluate the critically think, essentially, and evaluate the situation.
Yeah. Thank you so much for bringing that up, because this is a huge issue for people who have left high demand groups, and particularly second gen or multi-generational members. So it's very different for, say, my parents. They became devout, born again, evangelical Christians when they were in their like late 20s. So they had already, their personalities had formed, their likes and dislikes had formed, and they chose of their own volition this different ideology. I didn't have that opportunity, nor did my siblings. We were raised believing this is the only way. This isn't just one way. This is the only way. There's if you break with this ideology, there's going to be eternal consequences for you. So there was fear even around questioning, around tugging on that thread, because everything can unravel when you start doing that. And just not having the opportunity for a temperament and personality to develop apart from the constant input of, that's not godly enough. That's not, what would Jesus do? You're not allowed to say no to someone. You're not allowed to have a boundary, because everything you do is to be service oriented. You're always to be winning souls for the kingdom. Your life should be that kind of story. And then fast forward, we manage amazingly to get out, to separate ourselves from the ideology, and we're trying to reclaim and build our new secular identity. And people can feel so empty and so terrified, like, who am I? What do I believe? And so one place I like to start with clients is values clarification work. There are lots of worksheets. There are books about values clarification, really to start figuring out what values are important to me, not the ones my parents told me or the church told me, but what's important to me. So maybe obedience had been at the top before, or chastity. Oh, no, now at the top is autonomy for me over everything else. So that's part of the journey of just getting to know ourselves, and it takes time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably takes a lifetime. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't expect to ever fully recover. I just expect to just learn new things, and, you know, but maybe that's, it's I'm not trying to be pessimistic about it.
I think that's actually a really healthy way to look at it. And if we can manage not to look at the life that we had lived with shame and condemnation and guilt and judgment, but just simply with acceptance. Oh, this is what happened to me. I actually didn't have much of a choice in the whole thing, because my thinking was hijacked when I was in this group. And so I did some things I'm not proud of when I was under the influence. I'm no longer under the influence. So what choice do I want to make today according to the values I have and the direction I want to go today? I think that's just a really healthy way to look at it, rather than denying.
Yeah, I would agree. Wow. It's not always easy, but it's something, yeah, you just have to work on. So,
right. Yeah.
And I would like to mention, like, and I think this is probably going to resonate with a lot of people, what you said about purpose. For that 10 years, like with Scientology, and I'm sure with other ones, but with Scientology, you're not just working for your own salvation, I suppose you could, as a term you could use. Mm-hmm. It's literally, if you don't do everything you can now, there will be no opportunity to save everybody forever, mm-hmm. right? And I'm not talking about like next lifetime or whatever. It's forever. And so it is really, really pushed that you must do everything now. And everything's urgent. It's got to happen now. And so when you leave something like that, and now you're just like, you know, working a regular job and doing random stuff, you know, having fun, it's really difficult to like find that purpose and feel like anything has any value, mm-hmm. right? Which is something I've struggled with even now. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important really to mention that that's normal. right? Like that's,
yes,
it's important to find something that is important to you and work on that.
Yeah, which is what I'm
trying to do. So,
right. And so, one way that you're scratching that itch for yourself is through, your YouTube channel, interviewing people, being a guest on other people's podcasts, shedding light on, your own experience as a way to, validate other people's experiences and let them feel supported and to know that there's help out there. Yeah. It's the idea of purpose and meaning is such a profound part of being human. And in religion, that's given to us. It's kind of forced on us. We're told this is your purpose. And so we're surrounded by other people who believe in that purpose, and there's camaraderie and identity. And then when that's no longer our purpose, it can really plunge people into kind of existential angst. Why am I here? But I say that the meaning of life is to give life meaning. It's up to each person individually to determine what makes them feel good, what really gets them going. And that is part of your meaning. Do those mm-hmm. things. If it's spending time with friends, if it's producing content like you're doing to teach people, whatever it is, for some people it's photography, for some it's travel, learning about other cultures. It doesn't have to look the same, and it's not the same for everybody. Volunteering yeah. can be an excellent way also, but I think it really starts with the values clarification as we find out what is the most important to me. And then we align our lives with those values. And that's what you're doing right now. If an important value for you is helping other people, that's exactly what you're doing with your show.
Yeah. And that's my goal. And I mean, ultimately there's two purposes for it for me right now anyway, is to make sure no one else gets in Scientology and give people a platform to speak about their experience. You know, I've had two people on my show who have told their story for the first time.
Wow.
And, you know, they wouldn't have had an audience without it. So it's good to just put it out there. And yeah, it feels good to give those people someone to talk to.
Yeah. And what's your pushback been like? Have you been harassed, or have you heard from people who are still stuck in Scientology, really entrenched in there, and they disapprove of what you're doing?
Oh, yeah. certainly, as you know, you're watching my stuff. Recently, my father has learned that he is still in Scientology, although he is 80 and is battling lung cancer. It's not really active in Scientology, but still very much a believer. He has recently been told by my sister, my half sister, that I was making videos on the internet, and he said it was disgusting. And he hasn't watched any, and he has, as of a few weeks ago, has disconnected from me completely, because I'm making videos on the internet.
Wow.
And that's just the Scientology way. I also have another person who his family learned that they were speaking to me, and I'm a known anti-Scientology person, and they have officially disconnected from him as well, as of a couple days ago. So Scientology likes to say that's not a thing, like disconnection. Oh, we don't do that. We're all about the family connection and you know, all that bullshit, excuse my language, but it's absolute lies. They immediately disconnect and stop talking to anyone who is speaking out against it. But what they'll do is they'll say, oh, that's my choice. I choose not to talk to you. But in fact, it's not true, because it's Hubbard policy.
Oh, wow. So, and it's
that's the main pushback.
It's so painful. And really, in other terms, we might refer to it as shunning. And yeah. I hear a lot from Jehovah's Witnesses, people who've left Jehovah's Witness organization, some people who've left FLDS, Mormonism, certainly people who have managed to disengage from the Amish belief system or community. And it's just so painful. I mean, it's hard to imagine as a parent what my child could do that would make me separate from them. That in itself tells us that it's a It's a form of brainwashing, mental hijacking. People are acting under the influence because it really goes against our evolutionary way of needing community and nurturing bonds that we have in families. Yeah.
There is no love in Scientology. That's a fact.
Wow. Wow. The organization has to come first before everything else.
Oh, yeah, of course. Love is unconditional. That's what love is. And if there are conditions on love, then it's not love. Mm-hmm. And in Scientology, there are conditions on love.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yes. And so you were together with your partner for a number of years before you actually told her, shared in depth your experiences with her. What was the reaction there? Just tremendous support? Like, were you afraid that she was maybe going to have some rejection if she knew? Or
yeah, I don't know that I actually thought there would be a rejection, but it's always a fear, of course. Mm-hmm. Incredible support. And that's been since day one and continues to be. As people who may be watchers of my channel now or in the future, they'll see that she goes along with a lot of stuff that I do. She creates a lot of YouTube shorts that are trying to send a good message, and recently did a parody of the Super Bowl ad for Scientology, which is hilarious. That I'm sure that Scientology is not very happy about, but there's nothing they can do about it. I think one thing I really like to do is I like to use Scientology against Scientology, mm-hmm. because it makes it so easy, because then they can't deny anything. And that's, you know, obviously one of the ways I do it. But yeah, she's amazing. And she probably knows a lot more about Scientology and terminology than a lot of new members do at this point, right? Because mm-hmm. she's done a lot of reading and, you know, asked me a lot of questions.
Right.
We do live streams together sometimes. So
wow. Yeah. So it sounds like the way that Scientology is mainly getting new members at this point is internationally. So people who are less familiar with the cult, with the organization, and also people who potentially are in a desperate situation, they are looking to improve their life. They're hoping a move to North America or getting involved with this organization might actually improve their lot in life. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah. I mean, what they do, and they have been doing for decades, is what's called a personality test. And this is not a scientific personality test in the same sense as other actual ones based on psychological information. It's called the Oxford Capacity Analysis. It's nothing to do with Oxford University, by the way.
Right.
And it's 200 questions, and it creates a graph with different personality traits, which one's low, which one's high. And there's a full pattern that they follow for all the results. And the idea is to get the person in, they find what's called the ruin, which is the thing that's bothering them the most in their life, the thing that they really need to handle, that their attention's stuck on. And then literally, this is the pattern. They say, your problem is blah, blah, blah. Let's say your relationships with people. Scientology can help you with that. That's the exact wording that they'll use. They'll connect the problem with Scientology helping them. And then they'll sell them a course that's very inexpensive, you know, $50, $75 kind of thing, to get them hooked. And then they'll continue brainwashing and brainwashing. Most people leave, but there are certain people that will sign on and continue to do courses. And then you start running into issues like gaslighting, love bombing. There's going to end up being at some point the sunk cost fallacy, like where they've already put in $1,000, $2,000, $3,000. Well, let's just keep going, because there's always this little carrot dangled in front of their face that the next thing's going to handle your problem. It's constant. And that goes up until you reach the upper levels across the bridge, and you get to the end and realize that it's all just a nothing burger. And, you know, you just spent hundreds of thousands of dollars for nothing.
Right. Wow. Yeah, the sunk cost fallacy definitely comes into play, especially when people have, well, oftentimes been born into it. But even if they are, if they're first gen, but they've been in for, you know, 10 years or longer, and maybe they've tried to convert other people, they've tithed huge amounts to the organization or to the church or the group, it can be really hard psychologically and emotionally to embrace the fact that, oh my God, I just spent so much time and resources on this and it was the wrong thing, or I misunderstood it. I took it all literally, and actually none of it should have been taken literally. It was all fantasy or mythology or whatever. That can be so hard for people to come to that point. And so that's why I think it's even more amazing when people like you and Chris, and even me, who've come out of those backgrounds, then become very public with it. And, you know, rather than kind of sitting with any embarrassment around it, just open it all up to everybody and say, this was my experience. This is what I went through. And you're not alone if you're going through this. Did you read any, you know, cult help books, say by Dr. Yanya Lalich, Dr. Steve Hassan, any of those folks, Raquel and Ross? No?
No, I'm not a big reader, to be honest. I'm much more of a visual learner. And unfortunately, going to a Scientology school, you're taught, and it's hammered into your head in all of Scientology, that if you're reading something, you have to like have full conceptual understanding of everything. And so reading takes me a long time because I need to like look up words and, you know, read slower. Whereas people like my wife, for example, she can read a book really fast and she reads multiple books all the time. Mm-hmm. But I think, well, you don't understand it. And it's like, it's such a dumb thought, right? You can still get an idea. Anyway, so the point being, Scientology kind of ruined reading for me a little bit.
Right, right. Yeah, no kidding. What about watching shows about other cults? Like, do you ever do that? And then you recognize, oh yeah, that sounds familiar, even though it's a totally different group.
Yeah, I mean, I'm huge into different cults and, you know, true crime and, you know, serial killer type stuff, like trying to find out the psychology of things. Mm-hmm. And I know they're not necessarily directly connected, but there's a lot of familiarity with both of them, right? Mm-hmm. But for cults, yeah, just knowing that what I went through wasn't just Scientology. Scientology itself is unique, but all the techniques are there. It's all the same stuff. It's just in a different package.
Exactly. Yes. At some point along the way, our brains can get hijacked. And that's what happens, whether we fall into, well, really any type of extremism, radicalism, fundamentalism. So we're talking about it right now in a religious sense, because you and I come from religious groups and backgrounds, but it can happen in political groups, ecological, nutrition. We can be very prone to extremes. So I love that you're watching these different shows and learning and becoming familiar about potential blind spots. I think we would all benefit from that.
I think knowledge is the most important thing in any situation. The more information you have on something, the more in control you can be, the more you can make an informed decision. You know, it's simple. It's not exactly complicated, but I think so people lose sight of that.
Right.
They read something and they respond. They don't take a look to see if it's actually true or not.
Oh, it's so true. Yeah. And we've been primed to have emotional reactions rather than to think critically and sit with things. Like the way you said, you'll sit and think if you can feel an emotional response to something, then you take the time actually to sit with it and consider, well, now is that a Scientological, that's the word you used, reaction, or do I really feel that way? And that's marvelous, giving yourself that space to figure out what's really going on. Thank you so much for spending time with me today. How can people find you?
Well, they can find me on YouTube at PTS for Life. I do have an email that's for that account, is imptsforlife@gmail.com. If anyone wants to send me a message and say hi, I answer everything, I read everything, and I just like connecting with people. So
Awesome. This is great. I've really enjoyed getting to know you a little bit and hearing your story. If I can help out in any way with what you're doing, I'd love to be able to help. Thanks so much.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, everyone, thanks for joining us. And you can reach out to me. My website is divorcing-religion.com. I've just started a Tuesday night support group. It's free online. Go to my website. You can find out more. And I look forward to seeing you again soon. Take care, everyone.